It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferrick.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up on Central Time, white women make 87% of what men earn, and we'll find out more about what this means for women on this National Equal Pay Day.
First, if you're a Windows XP user, you might want to listen up. Today is the day that Microsoft officially ends support for their long-running operating system.
Having launched in 2001, XP went on to be Microsoft's most successful and popular operating system. But the problem now is that millions of people are still using it. If you're one of them, you might be wondering what this means for you.
And you might be wondering if you're one of the people still using it and you want to know how to find out. We asked WPR's in-house tech guy, Kevin Trueblood, to stop by and explain the options available to XP users. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, we knew this day, I guess, was going to come sometime. The system Windows XP has been supported for 12 years now. That's a long time, I guess, in computer terms. A lot of people are still using it, still loving it. How influential of an operating system is Windows XP?
Well, right now it's still in use in almost 1 in 4 machines that are running Windows. So for people who are still using Microsoft Windows, there's still 25%, about 25% of people using XP. So there's still a lot of machines out there.
And today is the day that Microsoft will officially stop supporting it. What exactly does that mean? What's different?
Well, what that means, well, first off, your machine's not going to turn into a pumpkin at midnight or anything like that. But what that does mean is that Microsoft is no longer going to offer support for it. So that means if you call them, they're going to say,
I'm sorry, Dave. I can't help you.
That's exactly right. That means that they're not going to be able to offer support, and also that they're not going to offer patches or security fixes. Traditionally, with an operating system, you know, people are very fixated on trying to find flaws that they can exploit in the software and use it for bad purposes. And when Microsoft catches wind of these, they rewrite the software and issue updates so that people can't exploit that flaw anymore. Well, now they're not going to offer those anymore.
That doesn't mean tomorrow my computer, if I have XP, is pirate haven, but over time it gets less and less secure, I imagine.
That's exactly right. It means that people who are running XP still face the risk of having their machines taken over, exploited, their security flaws exploited, and potentially overtaken by bad software. And there may not be much recourse because Microsoft's not going to fix it.
Before we get to what someone with XP can do, there are people out there asking, I've been in this situation, you know, I don't even know what operating system I'm running right now. How do we find out?
Well, Microsoft actually made it really easy. They set up a website called amirunningxp.com. That's all one word, amirunningxp.com. And it'll actually tell you if without any other input, you just bring up the web page and it will say, yes, you are running XP, or no, you are currently running something else.
For those people out there who get the answer yes when they go to website, I gather Microsoft wants people to upgrade to Windows 8, the new guy on the block. Looks pretty different. What can people expect if they make the transition from XP to Windows 8?
Well, there's a learning curve. And I should mention, too, that that isn't the only option. You can go up to Windows 7 still. It is possible to buy licenses for Windows 7. Windows 8, yes, there is definitely a learning curve in going all the way up to Windows 8. Primarily, Windows 8 was designed as a system to kind of bridge the gap between what are becoming popular with tablets and what you're using for a traditional computer. So the desktop got all boxy and colorful, and you just click this button and up comes Microsoft Word or up comes the internet. Now, since then, they've revised Windows 8 to make it a little bit closer looking to what you see in XP, but there's still quite a learning curve involved with Windows 8. Now, Windows 7, there is a different look to it, but it's a little bit more familiar for people who are going from XP to Windows 7.
You mentioned the phrase, buy a license. For switching from XP to 7 or 8, do people have to pay cash money to make that switch?
Yeah, so if you are looking at upgrading, you have a couple of different options. One being you can purchase an upgrade to preferably Windows 7 because you may not be able to have the hardware capable. Your computer may not be fast enough or capable enough to run Windows 8. But with Windows 7, you can buy an upgrade for around $100. The other option is you can just outright buy a new computer. I mean, if your machine is still running XP, it's likely 6 years old at least. And so it's probably time to upgrade anyway.
How will we know, assuming we don't want to get the new hardware, we just want to upgrade the operating system, how are we going to know if our computer is up to snuff enough to run 7 or 8?
Well, Microsoft does have tools that you can download. And if you do a Google search, you can ask, is my machine capable of running Windows 7? So there are some tools that you can download, and there'll be these little analyzers that'll tell you if your machine is capable of running Windows 7 or not.
Now, there are partisans out there listening to us saying, it's a great time to switch to something else, like maybe Apple.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't just put Apple's operating system on your Windows machine, if I understand correctly. But is this a time where you think some people are going to make the jump, not upgrade to a new Windows system, buy a new Apple computer?
Well, that's entirely possible. And that is certainly one option. The biggest obstacle for people going from PC to Mac, not only is the learning curve involved as far as learning a new computer, a new operating system, but also cost. Apple's Macintosh are ubiquitous. They are the same hardware, they're the same operating system, and they charge a premium for it. That's not to say that's a bad thing. They are great machines, but for some people who are used to the Windows architecture, used to maybe a Dell or a Gateway or an HP or something like that, going to a Mac is a learning curve, but it could be a good opportunity to go to something like that. But Apple also does the same thing. Eventually, if you're running an operating system, eventually they do end support for it, much the same way that Windows does.
And can you update that operating system, or do you have to get a new machine then?
No, you can update the operating system with Macs too. But much like with Windows, after 12 years, you're probably not going to be able to get updates for that operating system.
Some of the more tech-savvy people I know, the computer-savvy people, like Linux systems. I don't know much about them. Is that something that everyday consumers should be thinking about?
There are some models that you can get that come pre-installed with Linux, the most popular of which is a flavor called Ubuntu. And that's one of the things about Linux is there's several versions out there, if not more, of the way it looks, the way it operates, but they're all based around the same kind of core principles, the same language. But with Ubuntu has kind of grown in popularity simply because it's the one that looks and operates closest to Windows. But there is, again, a learning curve involved in going to something like that because there's a little bit more manual processes. There's not as much that happens automatically for you like Windows does. But a big advantage that Linux has is that it's free. You can download Ubuntu and you can download all the updates and there's no cost to it.
There are going to be people out there saying, I don't want to buy a new machine. I don't want to pay to upgrade. I'm comfortable in my XP operating environment, this thing that I've been working with for years. If people say, I'm going to keep XP and just keep working with it, any advice on how to minimize security risks and keep using it happily?
There are a lot of valid reasons to hang on to it, whether you have software that doesn't work on new versions and you don't want to upgrade. Maybe you have old hardware that's not compatible with 7. You don't want to buy new hardware. There's a lot of valid reasons, but you do definitely want to keep antivirus up to date. And a lot of the antivirus makers are going to continue to update their versions that run on XP. Similarly, for programs that protect against malware, that something bad that may be installed, they'll continue to work on that. Who knows for how long, but they at least will for the foreseeable future. So make sure those stay up to date. And then, you know, best practices, don't install things that look questionable. Don't go to websites that look questionable. That's, I guess, a relative term, but if something looks suspicious, it probably is. Just be careful about what you do, and that's true for even machines that are up to date. Just make sure that you're conscious of what you're clicking on. A lot of stuff that you want to install comes packaged with other things that you may not have intended to install. So just be careful about what you've gotten, especially programs like Flash and Java. Make sure those are continued to be updated as well.
There are rumors of a new Microsoft operating system coming up. Given their creative naming systems, the working title, I gather, is Windows 9. Who comes up with this? What do we know about that?
Well, it's kind of what's happening with Windows 8 is the joke kind of is Windows 8 is the new Windows Vista. And basically, Windows 9 is going to continue Microsoft's idea of kind of bridging between the tablet and the desktop, giving people the power that they want with the desktop, but with the kind of look and feel and ease of use that a tablet has. So they're still going to kind of continue the bridge between those two. And primarily, too, being able to run that same operating system. Microsoft has tablets that they sell, and being able to run that on their tablets as well as a desktop that you may be able to buy. So they're going to continue that. But with Windows 8, being like Windows Vista, not many people adopted Windows Vista because they didn't like the feel of it. Some things were still clunky, and a lot of people just waited until 7. Well, that kind of seems to be the joke, that that's what Windows 8 is going to be, is it's going to be the new Vista. Everybody's just going to ignore it. Adopt Windows 9 when it's stable.
Kevin, I really miss typing CD:/. Can I go back to DOS and forget all this fancy Windows stuff?
It still runs within Windows. You certainly could.
All right, Kevin, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
Well, thanks for having me.
That's Kevin Trueblood. He's our in-house technology guy here at Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, April 8th, is National Equal Pay Day. It marks how far into 2014 women had to work to earn the same amount of money men made in 2013, if I understand the calculations correctly. In Wisconsin, women only make about 78 cents for every dollar a man makes.
Laura Dresser is with us. She's the Associate Director for the Center on Wisconsin Strategy, or COWS. Laura, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So this is 2014. Why is there still such a sizable wage gap for women?
The wage gap has been a long-standing issue in the American labor market, probably in the global labor market. It relates to a number of factors, including outright discrimination, differences in choices, the kind of careers people choose, different pressures from family life that women face. There are a lot of reasons for a wage gap, but it remains very slow to close, and sometimes seems only to close when men's wages fall.
And what happens to the wage gap when we look at minority women?
Well, then if you look at the wage gap from a minority woman to a white male, the wage gap grows substantially. Latinas in the state make about 55 cents for every dollar white men make, and African-American women in the state about 63 cents compared to that 78 cents that was mentioned earlier, that is the white women's wage gap.
Yeah. So one of the reasons people have used to explain the wage gap has been that men are more educated. They get more higher degrees than women do. Is that even true anymore?
That's actually not true for the younger cohorts coming into the labor market. That is true in the past. But it's true also that for those younger cohorts coming in, even if you look at people in exactly the same major at the exactly as they enter with a 4-year college degree, the women face a wage gap from day one of about 5%, not 22%. Then if you look further down the road into their careers, about 12%. So over time, the wage gap grows, even for the people with the same education. So education isn't the whole answer. And a lot of that source on the wage gap is really closed because of the access of to really professional occupations that women didn't have a generation ago, lawyers, doctors, et cetera. Some of the high end has moved more.
So is it not profession-based then? If you're working in these higher paying jobs, then you're not quite as subject to the what we know about the wage gap. And if you're working a lower paying job, you're more vulnerable?
Well, I think women are vulnerable across the board to the wage gap and face different pressures. At the high end, you know, the stress of family and the need to take care of kids and kind of expectations around unstoppable schedules can be quite a problem and a glass ceiling. But then further down, women face other kinds of pressures, that their ability to, you know, take care of family life is sometimes, you know, even asking for a shift off in order to go to a parent-teacher conference can lead to losing your job. So further down in the labor market, it can be much more treacherous.
What about sheer numbers of hours worked? Does that factor into this at all? Do men simply work more hours than women?
Well, these wage gaps that we were talking about were annual full-time worker wage gaps. So we correct for the, you know, that these data take care of that question of hours. It's true that women more often work part-time because of those family pressures and other reasons. And it's true that there are lower hours, but these gaps are not about the hours. The gaps exist even considering hours differences.
Now, what about as people age and saving for retirement? We hear a lot about that and how people aren't saving enough. How does the wage gap affect women in their later years in life and their prospects for retirement?
Well, you know, a wage gap in a year, you know, 22% may seem, well, pretty significant, because of course you'd show up for a sale that had that much of a reduction. but 78 cents versus a dollar, maybe you don't think that's so much. But over the course of a 35-year working career, it's a difference in earnings of $1.2 million. Of 35 workers, that's the difference between a college graduate's wage, male and female wage. And so when you're saving on that money for retirement, that $1.2 million difference over the course of your life,
the interest doesn't add up quite as nicely.
Yeah, it makes a giant difference.
Well, let's zero in on Wisconsin now. How does Wisconsin look?
You know, Wisconsin, I think for a while was really coming up in terms of narrowing the gap. We saw some years when Wisconsin moved closer to the national number. We'd been behind it a little. Lately, Wisconsin's gap has sort of steadied out. And I think we saw that motion actually during the recession, mostly because of bad news for men. Which is a different kind of equity. It's not as good news.
Well, how does that play into this? I have seen that in terms of jobs lost in the economy, women are gaining those jobs back faster than men are. So what does that do to the mathematics of the wage gap?
Yeah, some people call this the man session because of the way it hit construction and manufacturing, especially early on. And because some of the strongest growth was coming in traditionally female sectors, education, healthcare, and hospitality. And so one thing that happens, there's a couple ways the math can work out. But one thing is that as the demand in men's sectors comes down and men's wages comes down, you end up having the wage gap close, even if women's wages are stagnant. And so, that's a kind of equity, but it's not quite as good feeling as when women's wages are moving up to men's.
Well, so speaking of good feeling, what would you like to see happen to close the wage gap?
Well, I think there's a lot of fronts to think about. I think it's interesting today, President Obama mentioned some policy action at the executive order level that will allow people to ask about wages. And one of the things that's very clear is that women just don't, that knowledge in any labor market, knowledge of what other people are earning is what gives you power to make a negotiation. And women far too often don't have that knowledge and in fact, not the ability to ask. And so partly this is just about getting more information out there. I think that matters a lot. I think changing expectations of kids and what's possible continues to matter. Having girls understand that math and science is possible, all that kind of work that we have done, I think matters a lot. But I think it also matters a lot to pay attention to the family constraints that everyone faces. Women disproportionately end up responding to those, whether that's kids or parents, sickness in the family, and that all impacts their ability to do their jobs. So the more that we have a kind of social surround on family work balance, the more that actually disproportionately helps women, but it helps us all because it's about really making, work more amenable to families and making women more able to respond to both.
Yeah, that's an argument that we've been hearing a lot from prominent feminists, including former Vermont Governor Madeleine Cunin, who says that is the next front of feminism, is dealing with the family, the whole family, because it does disproportionately affect women. So what kinds of policies do you think would be a good thing to help affect this?
There's a couple really important policies. The United States is one of the only countries in the world that does not provide paid family leave. So we got when a new child or adopted or is born into a house, maternal and paternal leave is not paid. You have the right to ask for it, but you don't have the right to be paid for that. There are insurance ways of developing programs like unemployment insurance that workers pay in, and then when they have a kid, they can, take the time they need, or when their parents are sick or they're dealing with serious family health issues, they can take the time and have some income flow, because so often the ability to ask for the time off isn't the question. The ability to afford the time off is the question, and this just allows workers. So that's one policy that matters. Another that matters especially to low-wage workers is to have earned sick leave so that you can be sick or you can be home with your child who's sick and still get your income from your job. Again, this is a policy that is pretty ubiquitous in the world that, you know, part of what a job comes with is some paid sick leave. But there's only recently been policy innovation on that front in the U.S.
Well, we're talking to Laura Dresser, Associate Director for COWS, about today, which is National Equal Pay Day.
And we want to hear from you. What do you think of the state of gender inequality in the American workplace, in the Wisconsin workplace? So do you see a wage gap where you work, or are things more equal, or do you not know because you don't know what anybody's getting paid? What would you like to see Wisconsin, the federal government, the corporate world do to address the wage gap? This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrick.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our discussion about Equal Pay Day with Laura Dresser, Associate Director for COWS, or the Center on Wisconsin Strategy.
And we want to hear from you. What do you think about the wage gap between men and women? Do you see this maybe as a problem in your workplace, or are things pretty equal there? What do you think Wisconsin or the federal government or the corporate world should do to address the wage gap, if anything? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@WPR.org.
And we'll go to the phones now. We've got Nick joining us in Green Bay. Hi, Nick.
I got two comments. Actually, the first one is, since your last story ran about Windows XP, it kind of kicked me in the butt to upgrade my computer.
Good. Glad we're helping.
And then the other comment is, my daughter and I are really into science. We're sitting on the couch watching something on the Discovery Channel or something because we really love science. And I looked at her and I said, so what do you want to do when you grow up? I said, would you like to be a scientist? And she's like, well, I want to, but I just can't be a scientist. I was like, why? She said, because I'm a girl. I said, are you serious? I said, anybody can be a scientist. And she's just shocked by the idea that she could be a scientist. She's like, it's only for boys. I'm like, no. I said, you can do whatever you want when you grow up. I said, you could be a scientist, which, and it just really blew me away that she said it was only for boys.
Yeah, I'm glad you had that conversation. How old is your daughter?
She's 5.
She's 5. Oh, well, she's pretty young yet, but that's an interesting point. Well, let's get our guest, Laura, on this. What about encouraging women from ages 5 and younger and older to go into the STEM professions?
Yeah, it's hard to know. I mean, it's clear that a lot of impressions about what's possible are formed when you're 5. And of course, one of the things that seems possible is being a princess. So, you know that that's going to go away. Some of this isn't completely real, but it is really important, I think. Even today, I think we hope or imagine that a girl's sense of possibility is as big as the world. But I think a lot of times there are a lot of social messages that say it's not, you know, whether it's the cast of The Big Bang Theory, which creates a kind of equivalence between geekiness and guyness, and then or whether it's, in the way that teachers respond to kids in class. But I think it's really important to just consistently be saying that message and holding up the examples of folks who don't look like what we think are scientists. Even today, that really matters. That sense of expectation and possibility is part of the answer.
And are those higher paying professions?
Yeah. I mean, consistently, the things that girls imagine or traditionally move into are lower paid, whether that's, the traditional women's list of occupations is nursing, clerical work, social work, and teaching. And that list is a list that is paid consistently less for a college degree than equivalents that men are more dominated by males. And so, it's important to kind of change that set of expectations. It's changed a lot, but as this story from Green Bay points out, it still needs to keep being taught.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for that call, Nick, and good luck to your budding scientists. Mm-hmm. And we'll go next to Daniel joining us from Milwaukee. Hi there.
Hello. Hi, Veronica. Big fan of your show.
Thank you.
And Laura, I really enjoyed your commentary so far. Appreciate the work you're doing to bring this issue to light.
Thanks.
I just wanted to say, I think there are three immediate things that we can do in the state of Wisconsin to both make the work home balance more sustainable and better for women, and also to decrease the wage disparity. One is to pass a bill to reduce discrimination based on family status, a similar bill to reduce discrimination based on pregnancy, to allow pregnant women to A lot of times in the workplace, they don't get to sit down or even just get a glass of water. And finally, we need to make laws in the state come back on the books that create equal pay for equal work, which I read somewhere is estimated to cost the state about $8 billion a year, the whole economy. So it's an issue that affects everybody and something that, you know, we can't finish it all in one day, but we can take steps in the right direction. So thank you.
All right. Well, thank you so much and appreciate you calling. And what do you think about that?
You know, that's a nice list of state policies that the legislature is considering. And I think it's, you know, those are all great things. I don't know that they'll come out the other side of the legislative process, but it's good that they're at the start of that equal pay for equal work, especially. But all of them, the family status, important, critical as well. You know, one other thing I would put on the list, too, is the minimum wage. 60% of workers who toil at the bottom of the labor market at the minimum wage are women. So when you raise the minimum wage, you actually close the wage gap. And that's another policy that is in consideration up at the Capitol by the folks there. So that's another opportunity.
All right. Great. Appreciate that call. And we'll move next to Patrick joining us in La Crosse. Hi, Patrick.
Hi there. I've enjoyed your show today. Thank you.
Thank you. And what do you think about the wage
question.
Gap?
Oh, what I think about it? Well, actually, I have a quick question. Mm-hmm. So my question is, regarding the wage disparity between men and women, are women facing difficulty finding higher-paying positions and promotions that men might get, or are they being simply paid less for the same work?
I think the answer is just is both. You know, there's some of both of those things matter. So sometimes it is connections and information or where, you know, the locker room conversation that they're not included in or the kind of sense of what the opportunities for promotion are that happen in some space that they're not included in. But also, you know, it is true that you can find women in the exact same jobs and paid less for the exact same job. So I think both things are going on in that net number.
Okay, thank you so much, Patrick, for the call. And Laura, how would you say overall the wage gap affects Wisconsin's economy on the whole?
Well, I think, you know, there's a couple different ways to measure it. And Daniel's call earlier indicated one of them is that, you know, if women earned what men earned, that would be a lot of money in family budgets. And if you close that wage gap, and this is one reason that I think sometimes this is painted as a women's issue, and clearly it matters most to women and their paychecks. But in fact, women's money, women's earnings is part of family income. And if you close that gap, you actually increase family earnings. And it's a very significant increase to family earnings. I've seen the number, but I don't have it at the top of my head right now, the total number, some millions, many millions for the state economy.
And if you're talking about affecting the family budget overall, would closing the wage gap also then improve rates of, for instance, child poverty, child hunger, things like that?
Yeah, that for sure. If women's wages were higher, women, you know, 40% of children are in families headed by single women. Those women's wages, you know, then are the sole support and one of the principal reasons we have the problem with child poverty in this nation and state that we do. Better earnings for those women means less poverty for those kids.
And are you optimistic that the wage gap will close, at least tighten, maybe over the next several years?
Well, you know, I think the most positive story over the last generation is really the story of college-educated professional women. That my story, relative to my mother's story, for example, is, you know, that I have had a lot more opportunity, both in terms of the education I achieved and the things I could do with it. I think that's true of this generation relative to the previous one, and one of the reasons we've seen the gap close. That feels like that's pretty much stabled, sort of gotten as close as it's going to get. And I think looking forward, we really have to look, I think, much more consistently to the bottom of the labor market and to equalizing from the bottom to the top, regardless of gender, and pulling up the bottom because that does help a lot of women, and thinking more about this family balance issues. Those are the places where it will really matter in terms of closing the gender gap, but making life more livable for people, especially at the bottom of the U.S. and Wisconsin labor markets.
All right. Well, let's see if we can get in one more call here and take Lynn, who is joining us from Eau Claire. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Veronica. It is my opinion that in order to close the disparities in all employment, that people ought to re-educate themselves on the importance, the history and the importance of unions. It was the tragedies in the garment workers district that befell mostly women that led to the International Garment Workers Union. And union rights, they're for all workers across the board. And people have become terrified of the power of unions. But union rights are civil rights. Unions work across the board for workers. And you've got the health insurance, an 8-day workday, vacations, all of those, even as far as the ability to access education. Thank the unions for that.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling us up, Lynn, sharing your thoughts with us. And obviously a hot-button issue here in Wisconsin is cows have a position about the wage gap and unions.
Well, I think, you know, the research has a position about wage gap and unions, and that is that union work sites have done some of the best work on equal pay for comparable work, for considering how you begin to close the gaps, you know, across the public sector in Washington State, for example. It was unions who really drove an effort that that whittled away some of that wage gap between even different sorts of jobs. And it's great to have a union for equal pay for equal work and for that knowledge of what people are getting paid. So some of those basic negotiating issues that can hurt women are solved in a union worksite.
Laura, thank you so much for coming by today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure to be here.
That was Laura Dresser, Associate Director for the Center on Wisconsin Strategy, otherwise known as COW. She was here to talk with us about National Equal Pay Day.
It's time for Teach Me What You Know, our weekly segment where we learn how to do something new. Last week, we learned how to get our bikes ready for spring. This week, we've got a wildlife expert with us to teach us how to birdwatch now that we've got lots of migratory birds coming back to Wisconsin for warmer weather.
Andy Palios is a wildlife biologist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Andy, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I understand spring migration is kicking off in Wisconsin at long last. This is sort of the season, I gather, for bird watchers. So for novices who want to get out there and start birding, what do you need to start?
Yeah, well, this is a great time of year. Lots of birds coming back and lots of bird song in the woods and in the backyard. The first couple of things you need are good optics. So you're going to want to have a good pair of binoculars that can really help you get a good look at some of these birds that are either way up in the tree or way out in the wetland or way out in the grassland. And then you're going to want to get at least one, but most of us who are addicted to birding have 5 or sometimes 15 bird books, bird field guides, and all sorts of things that you can study just to kind of help you get a feel for what birds are in your area and what to look for in order to identify them.
You tipped us off to a new kind of binocular strap for the hardcore birder. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah. So the old school binocular straps fit around your neck, and of course, if you're lugging around a heavy pair of binoculars all day, you get a bad case of warbler neck or whatever you're looking at. But the newer straps are kind of a harness that fit over your shoulder and then around the front of your body, and that just sort of takes the weight off of you as you're running around looking for birds or other things.
They don't sound like the most attractive things, binocular strapped to you, but are people going to look at you funny if you wear that?
Yeah. I mean, your manhood will be questioned at some point wearing basically an elaborate bra with a binocular attached to it. But
is it sold as a bronocular?
It could be. There's a joke in there somewhere.
Well, so now that we are hearing about the equipment, some new innovations on the birding trail, where should we go to start looking for and identifying some of these spring birds?
Yeah, well, I mean, for beginners, I would say that, you know, you can always watch birds anywhere. You can watch birds in your backyard. You can watch birds at the local city park. Most of us, I think, sort of learned how to bird watch just by watching birds at our bird feeders in the backyards. But Wisconsin DNR and a lot of the bird conservation groups around the state have produced a lot of cool publications that give folks an idea of where to go to see birds and different kinds of birds and what time of year is the best. So DNR provides a whole series of birding and nature trail publications that have hot spots that you can watch birds at. Go ahead.
Well,
Sorry, go ahead.
All right. Well, I want to check out some of the birds that are coming back to Wisconsin right about now. Let's start. I always love seeing these guys, the sandhill cranes. Let's give a little listen. So cranes coming back, where can we go to find them?
Well, right now, cranes are all over the place. Of course, I have to remember that my friends in northern Wisconsin still have 3 feet of snow on the ground. For the rest of us, going out to these wetlands and sort of low, wet, grassy areas out in the big open fields are great places to watch cranes. And if you're somewhere along the lower Wisconsin Riverway where they come in to roost at night or some of these big marshes, you should be able to hear cranes right now because they're reclaiming their territories and keeping all the sort of interlopers away. So they're really loud and really easy to find right now.
We just heard what they sound like. What do they look like?
Yeah, they're kind of like a big, I always think of dinosaurs when I think of cranes. They look like a big pterodactyl walking through a field. It's a tall wading bird that's sort of a sandy gray with a little red cap. And often you can see them from a distance, but oftentimes if you're just sort of walking down the road, you'll hear them first from a long ways away, and then you can go find them.
Now, one thing that can be tricky for beginning bird watchers or people just learning to use binoculars is how to track. So you see a bird up in a tree, and then you raise your binoculars, and for the life of you, you can't see the bird in your binoculars. Do you have advice for how to actually track and make sure you're actually spotting the bird?
Yeah. Of course, they don't stay still like they should, but The best thing to do is always keep your eyes on the bird, and then as you bring your binoculars up to your eyes, you should be in the right spot. So instead of kind of getting your eyes to binoculars and then wandering around getting dizzy, you really want to keep your eyes focused on the bird in the tree and then bring your binoculars to that spot.
I'm so glad you asked that, Veronica. I look down at the binocular, lift it up to my eye, and then I'm looking at a different angle, and I never see the bird. Okay, a valuable lesson learned. That's great. Well, how about let's give a listen to another bird now. This will be the eastern meadowlark. So is that a seasonal one, Andy, that we should be looking for now?
Yeah, they're one of the first. They're a nesting bird of the grasslands, so the big prairies and grasslands on public and private land. And they are one of the first grassland birds to come back for the year. And in fact, we just saw a couple today when we were out doing a prescribed fire. So they're back and they're around, and they've got a great loud sort of spring of the year song. And they're just a great bird to practice on if you're a beginning birder.
One thing that's especially fascinating about beginning to birdwatch is we're hearing like the variety of bird calls. Do you get to a point where you can just identify a bird based on its song alone?
Yep, and my wife and most of my friends make fun of me that I pretty much am constantly birdwatching with my ears and can basically interrupt people in conversations to tell them that a certain bird just sang. So once you start learning that, you can never really turn it off, so it becomes quite addicting. But most of the good birders can really, really identify most of the birds as they sort of hear them flying by or in the bushes.
And here's a call that we probably should be hearing quite a bit of right about now. Some honking in the background, but the primary bird, I think, was the red-winged blackbird.
Yeah. Yep, and they're back on territories and even come into people's feeders a little bit, too, as they migrate north. So red-winged blackbirds are a really great one for beginners because it's a pretty easy one to identify. It's a blackbird with a red patch on its wing, and they have that neat conquery song.
It helps me out when the name of the bird is also the description of the bird. I know when I'm seeing a red-winged blackbird, but stay away from their nests, right? My daughter found that out the hard way one time.
Yeah, they can be pretty. So the males, they nest in sort of a colony, and the males all band together to chase predators away. So, every now and then they get pretty aggressive. So,
now the red-winged blackbird is kind of ubiquitous right now. Even Rob can find them, apparently.
Oh, yeah.
But what if you want the holy grail of birding? Is it going to be your warblers that you're looking for?
Well, I mean, there's always people that argue about that. You have some people who are big-time raptor people and other people who are really into ducks or warblers. But as we get into May, basically most birders are very heavily focused on warblers because there's 30 different species and they're all really super colorful and pretty and little feathered jewels that sort of just land in the woods next to you. So,
well, another resource, how about the community of birders? Are birders usually willing to help people get started?
Absolutely. There's some great organizations out there, different Audubon Society chapters, bird clubs, and the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. And what I always tell beginning birders is get a really good pair of binoculars because you're going to have them for the rest of your life and link up with a bird club or a mentor of some sort because you can really learn a lot from other birders. And birders are very connected now with social networking. So there's Wisconsin Birding Facebook groups, and there's great email listservs and lots of different websites. You can go onto the DNR and put birding into the DNR website and get connected to a lot of those different opportunities.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that Bob from Door County called us to say Sandhill Crane Count happens the second Saturday in April, which is this Saturday. And there's contact information available at the International Crane Foundation. And as we head into the season where there are so many birds to see, the cranes and the red-winged blackbirds and the warblers coming up too, do you have a favorite spot in Wisconsin to bird? Now, you may not want to give away your your secret birding grottos, but what is a great spot if you just want to go and see some great birds?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many, but my top all-time favorite spot in Wisconsin is Crex Meadows State Wildlife Area in Burnett County, way up in the northwest part of the state. But if that's too far away from you, there's great places all along the Wisconsin River, Wyalusing State Park, Devil's Lake State Park. And the great thing about Wisconsin is really in every county in this state, there is a really, really good natural area and birding spot that you can explore.
Any last piece of advice or encouragement you have for someone who wants to give it a try?
Yeah, I mean, get out there, enjoy the natural world, and do your best to hook up with some other birders because there's lots of field trips. Natural Resources Foundation has all kinds of great field trips that'll get you started.
Andy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That was Andy Polios, a wildlife biologist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. He was with us to teach us how to birdwatch.